And it's known to the encyclopedias and to the history books for only two reasons. In both cases, people who spent a very short period of time in the town. The first, of course, is the Pied Piper of Hamel. In 1254, according to the legend, rats infested the town, and a piper happened to come through, and he offered to pipe the rats out of Hamel in exchange for a certain fee, and a contract was written and duly signed, and the fee was stipulated, and he in fact did pipe the rats out of Hamel, according to the legend. And then the townspeople tried to renege on the contract, and they called him a sorcerer, and they drove him out of town. So he got his revenge by coming back into town and playing a tune on his pipe, which attracted all the children, except for one who was lame, couldn't follow him, and he led the children to their death. Otherwise, for about 500 years, Hamel slept in well-deserved anonymity, until in the late 17th century, a Jewess, a 14-year-old little girl, went to Hamel to be married, and stayed in Hamel for a year, and then had the good sense to leave the town. But because in Germany, in the towns of medieval Germany, not only did every Jew have to wear on his garment some indication of his Jewishness, but every Jewish home had to have on its door a shield indicating its Jewishness, since apparently she took, or her family took as its shield when they moved back to Hamburg, the shield of the town of Hamel, put it outside their door. She was called Glückel of Hamel, and when about 80 years after her death, historians discovered the memoirs which she'd written in Yiddish about her life, they began to call her Glückel of Hamel, and so she is known to this day, and so she resides in that great Temple of Immortality, the Encyclopedia Britannica, if you want to look her up there. Now, Glückel came as a child's bride to Hamel. She'd been born in Hamburg in 1645. She was destined to die some 78 or 79 years later in Alsace-Lorraine, a town called Metz. Her memoirs are one of the very few which come to us of a personal nature from those centuries, and she's worth talking about because she was a woman of verve. She had a good mind, a good eye, and she wrote seven little scenes from her life, which were bound together by her descendants and are known as her memoirs. They've been translated, at least in abbreviated form, into English, and now available. Now remember what I suggested to you. She came to Hamel at the age of 14 to be married. She'd actually been engaged at the age of 12. Now, in Germany, in the 17th century, the early engagement and the early marriage suggested that she came from a fairly wealthy family, because those who were well-to-do tried to arrange the marriage of their children while they were still young, before they would suffer or know all of the thrusts, sexual and otherwise, of what we now call adolescence, to see that they were safely settled. And they tried to marry off their children while they were young and still in good fortune, because fortunes came and fortunes went with amazing rapidity. It was a question, they always talked of the wheel of life which spun around. Oh, you were up one day and down the next. You could make a fortune one day and lose it the next month. And while they still had the dowry to buy a fit mate for their son or for their daughter, they wanted to secure the bargain, because that meant that that child at least was well established before the fickle finger of fate, you know, did what ought not to be done to you. The early marriage also made for some rather unusual family occasions. It would be hard to imagine a home today in which a mother and a daughter would be in bed preparatory to delivery in the same room in the same house at about the same time. That's exactly one of the incidents that Glückel describes. When she was pregnant with her first child, the child turned out to be a daughter by the name of Tzipora, she would, in the course of her childbearing years, give birth to 12 children, a not unusual number, except that most women died before they had delivered that number of children. She and her mother were in bed with their children the same week. They delivered within 4 days of each other. And the delivery was not only not atypical, the twin deliveries, but resulted in one of these typical household scenes, which she described with some vigor, but we can hardly imagine. Both women went to sleep. Apparently the mother got up in the middle of the night and went to nurse her child and picked a child out of a cradle and brought her back to bed. The 16-year-old went to get her child. She found the crib empty, the cradle empty, and she set up a geschrei. And she awakened the whole house, and she disoriented the mother, and the mother was said, "I've got my child, not your child." Before the whole thing was settled, everybody had been awakened, and it had been tumult, and finally everybody got a good laugh out of it and went back to sleep. Which means what? Which means that in these families, it was not at all unusual for children to be a generation apart. And when one spoke of a generation gap, if the word existed in those times, obviously it didn't, a parent and a child could be able to share a generation much more than you could have almost a grandchild relationship with a parent, and you could have a child who had a parent relationship towards a sibling. Now, Glückel's mother had 7 or 8 children. It's hard to figure out the number. Glückel herself had, as I said, 12. Her mother was 32 or 33 when she delivered the child, when Glückel was in bed at the age of 16. Families tended to be younger, and there were always a lot of young children in the home. Almost no one in the home of a child nature above the age of 13 or 14. You had a kind of sandwich relationship. That is, you had a lot of children up to the age of puberty and through the age of puberty. We had almost nobody in what we call today the teenagers, young adults. They were already off establishing their own homes. And then you had the parents' age themselves and whatever elderly folk also inhabited the household. Now, to think of a girl married at the age of 14, engaged at the age of 12, from the perspective of this era of woman's liberation, is almost inevitably to assume that this child had to be a bartered bride, that she had been given very little except training in the kitchen, how to raise children, and how to take care of the housewifely duties. It's interesting to note, first of all, that Glückel was obviously literate. She could not only read Yiddish, but write Yiddish. She could not only read German, we're told, but write German. She knew Dutch. She read quite easily. And as was the case in so many of these homes, there was a resident tutor, usually a man who had had some rabbinic training in what they called the East. He was Ostjuden, a Jew from the East, usually from Poland, who had received yeshiva training and who was brought into the house to teach the young, but who had in addition the responsibility of teaching the women of the house, or reading to the women of the house. For she read a great deal of what's called Musar literature, ethical literature, which tells about how to act and how to behave and the responsibilities of wives, of children, of the responsibilities to the aged, courtesy, manners, and things of this type. Now, Glückel was not atypical of women of her age. When we think today of the Jewish woman, we tend to think of the woman from Eastern Europe, from Hasidic backgrounds, who was really relegated to a non-person status, except that she did all the most important things, like earning the living and keeping the family together. But when the Hasidic Rebbe talked to her, he turned her back to her. In Central Europe, this was not the case. Glückel's father was not at all unusual in that he taught his daughters as well as his sons and set up a school for them in the home. She had a stepdaughter, a stepsister, who not only knew German and Yiddish, but was also fluent in French. An interesting achievement for a German girl of the time. And an achievement which in the end, according to Glickel, and this is how we know it, turned to be a matter of some safety for her father. It turns out that her father, who was among other things a money lender, had lent out to the local lord some money against a deposit of some kind or other, we're not told what. And the lord and another noble friend of his came to the house, and they had a big ruse established as to how they would reclaim the deposit without paying back the monies that were owed. And while the father was going to his storeroom to pick up the deposit in order to return it in return for the monies which they didn't have and which were not available, these two noblemen spoke in French, which was the language of the upper classes. And Glückel's sister, stepsister, overheard them, of course understood them, and in Yiddish told her father when he came back to the room not to show the deposit, and everything was undone, you know, and her father's, a part of her father's fortune was saved. There is a whole body of literature which developed in the 16th and 17th century as a kind of supplement to the halachic scholarly literature, which was the staple of the rabbinic yeshivot, of Talmudic training, which was developed in largest measure for the use of the delectation of the women, an educated woman's class, a rather fascinating kind of literature, and which is in many ways, according to those who study this material, the forerunner of the great Yiddish novels of the 19th and 20th century. It's a literature which was fed in part on translations of medieval romances. The Arthurian legends were translated into Yiddish, till Eulenspiegel was translated into Yiddish. What have we got? Wind, oh. You know, if it was through Germany in the 17th century, we would have the evil spirits abroad in the room, and we'd have to perform all kinds of incantations and wear amulets and do something of the kind. In any case, they translated these romances from the medieval times. They took much of the material which appears in the Midrash, the more romantic Midrashim, the more adventurous Midrashim, and translated them. And they arranged them in various anthologies. One which was particularly important was called Sena Rena, Go Out and See. And Glickel often talks of reading it and some of what they call the Maaseh books. Books of wonder tales about the rabbis, or about Alexander the Great, or about other of the great figures that came down from the legendary histories. A number of these anthologies had in fact been drawn together by women. We don't think of women as authors in the Jewish tradition down to our century. But you will find as early as 1612, a woman by the name of Rebecca Tichtenner, Rebecca Tichten we'd call her today, has drawn together an anthology of proverbs, aphorisms, advice to housewives. A little bit of Dear Abby is in here, and a lot of tall tales, and had published this and had gained a certain amount of currency. Now, the great scholars didn't censor any of this material, but looked down their noses at it. But this became the popular lore, and men snuck their look at it as well as women. In fact, became fascinated by this literature because it was easier, and it dealt with the more human problems, the less abstruse philosophic and Talmudic problems. And a whole folk literature begins to emerge out of the need to supply the intellectual needs of women like Glückel of Hameln. To give you a sense of this literature, let me read the opening few pages of Glückel's own book. In a translation that was done about 35 years ago by Marvin Lowenthal. You'll see a little bit of the memoir and how she uses these stories from our tradition, and the whole thing within a very pious but also very acerbic and precise and observant frame. I began writing this memoir, dear children, upon the death of your good father, in the hope of distracting my soul from the burdens laid upon it, and the bitter thought that we have lost our faithful shepherd. In this way, I have managed to live through many wakeful nights, and springing from my bed shortened the sleepless hours. This, dear children, will be no Musar book, no book of morals. Such I could not write, and our sages have already written many. Moreover, we have only our holy Torah, in which we may find and learn all that we need for our journey through this world to the world to come. The Torah is like a rope which the great and gracious God has thrown to us as we drown in the stormy sea of life, that we may seize hold of it and be saved. It's an old Talmudic symbol. The kernel of the Torah is this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But in our days, we seldom find it so, and few are they who love their fellow men with all their heart. On the contrary, if a man can contrive to ruin his neighbor, nothing will please him more. The best thing for you, my children, is to serve God from your heart without falsehood or sham, not giving out to people that you are one thing while God forbid in your heart you are another. Say your prayers with awe and devotion. During the time for prayers, do not stand about and talk of other things. While prayers are being offered to the Creator of the world, hold it a great sin to engage another in talk of an entirely different matter. Shall God Almighty be kept waiting until you have finished your business? Jews talked in shul in those days, as in this. Moreover, put aside a fixed time for the study of the Torah as best you know how. Then diligently go about your business, for providing your wife and children a decent livelihood is also a mitzvah, the command of God and the duty of man. We should, I say, put ourselves to great pains for our children. For on this, the world is built. Yet note this. Yet we must understand that if children did as much for their parents, the children would quickly tire of it. And then she gives the Musa an example. A bird once set out to cross a windy sea with its three fledglings. The sea was so wide and the wind so strong, the father bird was forced to carry his young one by one in his strong claws. When he was halfway across with the first fledgling, the wind turned into a gale, and he said, "My child, look how I am struggling and risking my life in your behalf. When you are grown up, will you do as much for me and provide for my old age?" The fledgling replied, "Only bring me to safety, and when you are old, I shall do everything you ask of me." Whereat the father bird dropped his child into the sea, and it drowned. And he said, "So shall it be done to such a liar as you." Then the father bird returned to shore, set forth with a second fledgling, asked the same question, and receiving the same answer, drowned the second child with the cry, "You too are a liar." Finally, he set out with a third fledgling. And when he asked the same question, the third and last fledgling replied, "My dear father, it is true you are struggling mightily and risking your life in my behalf, and I shall be wrong not to repay you when you are old, but I cannot bind myself. This, though, I can promise. When I am grown up and have children of my own, I shall do as much for them as you have done for me." Whereupon the father bird said, "Well spoken, my child, and wisely, your life I will spare, and I will carry you to shore in safety." Now, when you read stuff like this, and you hear some of the romantic nonsense that's put out as Judaism, you recognize that our tradition is far more realistic than those who oversell it often make it out to be. Anyway, she continues. "Above all, my children, be honest in money matters with both Jew and Gentile, lest the name of heaven be profaned. If you have in hand money or goods belonging to other people, give more care to them than if they were your own, so that, please God, you do no one a wrong. The first question put to a man in the next world is this: was he faithful in his business dealings? Let a man work ever so hard amassing great wealth dishonestly. Let him during his lifetime provide his children fat dowries, and upon his death a rich heritage. Yet woe, I say, and woe again to the wicked, who for the sake of enriching his children has lost his share in the world to come. For the fleeting moment, he has sold eternity." Again, the rabbi pauses. I often hear, it's said Judaism is a this-worldly religion. 20th century Judaism in this modern American liberal form is a this-worldly religion. Rabbinic Judaism lived for the world to come. That's where their mind was set. That's where the ultimate reward would come. Then she continues, "When God sends evil days upon us, we shall do well to remember the remedy contrived by the physician in the story told by Rabbi Abraham ben Shabtai Levi. A great king, he tells us, once imprisoned his physician and had him bound hand and foot with chains and fed on a small dole of barley bread and water. After months of this treatment, the king dispatched relatives of the physician to visit the prison and learn what the unhappy man had to say. To their astonishment, The physician looked as hale and hearty as the day he entered his cell. He told his relatives he owed his strength and well-being to a brew of 7 herbs he had taken the precaution to prepare before he went to prison, and of which he drank a few drops every day. They asked, "What magic herbs are these?" And he answered, "The first is trust in God, the second is hope, the others are patience, recognition of my sins, joy that in suffering now I will not suffer in the world to come, contentment that my punishment is not worse as well it could be, and lastly, knowledge that God who thrusts me into prison can, if he will, at any moment set me free." That's the faith of the medieval Jew. However, Glucko continues, "I'm not writing this book in order to preach to you." She's done a pretty good job of that. "But as I've already said, to drive away the melancholy that comes with the long nights. So far as my memory and the subject permit, I shall try to tell everything that has happened to me from my youth upward. Not that I wish to put on airs or pose as a good and pious woman. I'm a sinner. Every day, every hour, and every moment of my life, I have sinned, nearly all manners of sin. God grant that I may find the means and occasions for repentance. But alas, the care of providing for my orphan children and the ways of the world have kept me far from that state." And then she goes on. It's worth the reading. Now let's look at Glucko's world a little bit. The book consists of 7 sections. 5 of them were written, as she suggests here, when she was in her middle 40s, after the death of her first husband. And note that she was in love with her husband. Now, she had never met her husband till her wedding day. And that was true of almost everyone in that world. But she grew to love him, and she obviously fell into despondency and a deep depression when her husband died. The other 2 chapters were written when she was in her 70s. After a second marriage, a marriage to a man who, when she married him, was the leading Jew of a town called Metz in Alsace-Lorraine, a man who'd been the Parnasse, the great leader of the community, a man of great wealth, again a man she'd never met until the day she married him. Now, she arranged this marriage. The first marriage, her father arranged for her. But the remarriage by an adult was arranged by the adult themselves, with the aid and on the recommendations of children. The suggestion came from a daughter of hers, Esther, who lived in Metz, who knew this man was a widower and was looking for a wife. No one was to live alone. Celibacy was not condoned or declared to be a virtue in any way, shape, or form. And unfortunately, a war broke out right after her marriage, and within 2 years of her marriage, this very wealthy man was bankrupt, and she lived out her last days with a man that she was not that much in love with, but in poverty, and fighting the fight that many elderly people fight to avoid going to live with her daughter. And one of the most poignant of the sections of the book is the last, in which she describes how she lives in a rented one room with a servant of some kind in Metz, and often has no food during the day, though her daughter is now the wife of the richest man in Metz, is importuning her to come and live with them. That's a mitzvah for the daughter or the son to bring the mother in, but she's fighting for independence, she's fighting for her dignity, she's fighting that sturdy fight which so many elderly people fight to still be able to make the decisions, to have the freedom to make the decisions which will give them control over their lives. And then finally, during the last 3 or 4 years of her life, she has to give in, she needs the care, and she finally goes over to live with her daughter. Glucko had 12 children. 5 of them died before she died. And note, I didn't say that they used the Yiddish expression, she buried 5 children, because she was not at the funeral of 4 of them. That's because she couldn't come to a funeral, but because they died away from her. 3 of her children, from the day of their marriage, were never seen again by their mother. That means you raised a child to the age of 12, 13, or 14, you married off the child to another town, and that often was the last you saw of that child, because you couldn't get into your Buick and go the 50 miles to Akron and see your child and come back the same day, nor could you get into an airliner and fly to California. Travel was dangerous. Travel was difficult. You travel at most 7 or 8 miles a day. Germany at this town was not a nation. Germany was divided into about 118 different self-governing political units. And that is to say, it had 118 people with armies and borders and boundaries, bishops and dukes and grand electors and free cities. And you had to pay toll and show your papers and pass through customs. And between the towns, there was a no man's land where robbers and all kinds of things lay in wait. And some of the most tearful pages of the book are times when she describes how a rumor would come into her town that the ship bringing back her husband from the great fair in Amsterdam had been shipwrecked in the Skagerrak, or in the North Sea. And she would run to the seacoast some miles away. It would take her several days to get there to find what had happened, only to find that nothing could be found out, nothing was to be heard, no one had heard of the shipwreck. And when she came home, there was her husband, fortunately, sitting there waiting for her. But these people traveled a great deal, particularly the kind of person that Chaim Hamel, her husband, was, that is, a merchant. They traveled from fair to fair. They traveled throughout the northern and western part of Germany, throughout Holland, as far as Vienna in the south. They were gone for great periods of time. It was very dangerous to be gone. A married woman was very much a widow, you know, part of every year, because the fair was the great mercantile mart where business was done. And you grew to be rather unromantic. You couldn't give in too much to your emotions. Tears came easily. Fear came easily. And you fought against involving yourself too desperately, too deeply in any one person's life. 5 children predecease her. 3 of them she sees never again after the age of 13 or 14, and she could expect that. Everyone did in this world. You couldn't romanticize the child-parent relationship. You couldn't allow it to be one which would absolutely destroy you if a child died. And as a matter of fact, there's some very interesting portions in here where she begins to reflect on whether or not she had not fallen too deeply in love with her husband. Because, in effect, when he dies, she goes into a period where she's no longer really as capable of managing her life as she needs to be in order to survive. A certain coldness, in other words, a certain hardness develops around the spirit as a self-protective device. And I've often, you know, wondered how it was that in the Nazi period, families could ship children off, you know, in the hopes they would get to safety. Just send them away. And yet, obviously, something of that kind of strength is required. We can talk more about that if we want later on. Let's talk about this, the realities of life and the kind of emotions you cannot allow yourself and the kinds of demands that are put on you during this world. She was born 3 years before what we know in Jewish history as the Great Cossack or Chmelnytsky Massacres, when the Cossacks erupted out of southern Russia and went through Bulgaria and Romania and Hungary and southern Poland, almost to the Baltic, and killed in passing 1 Jew in every 3. Until the Holocaust of the 1930s, it was the worst destruction that Jewish life suffered in Europe after the Spanish exile of 1492. Now, this didn't reach as far as Hamburg, where Glückel had been born and where she was living again after she pulled her husband out of this backwater town called Hameln. But at one point she tells us, when she was a child, a group of about 12 or 14 Eastern Jews come into Hamburg and knock on the door of the house and ask for some kind of succor. They're penniless, they're sick. They're escaping from this kind of disaster. The father, in a sense, says, don't take them in. We can't provide for them. They're sick. You don't know what illness they have. The grandmother, her grandmother, who's a rather remarkable figure, says, the attic is for them, and I'll take care of them. And she takes them up to the attic, and a number of them die, but the grandmother nurses a few of them through, and and they survive. And Glückel remembers this from their earliest day. It was a world in which there were refugees on the road. It was a world in which you feared the plague. The plague breaks out in Hamburg when Glückel is about 22 or 23. She happens to be leaving with her husband and her three or four young children to a fair in Hanover. And tragedy strikes in the sense that as they approach Hanover, her eldest daughter, a child now 5 or 6, comes down with sores, which look like the festering sores of the plague. And the problem is what to do. They can't tell anyone that the child may have the plague. And the first thing we would do is to call a doctor. If they were to call a doctor, first of all, a doctor more often killed than not in those worlds. But if they were to call a doctor, the doctor would tell the authorities, and the authorities would, without thought, kill the entire family as a means of preventing the plague from spreading to the town. So they consult with a couple of the Jews of the town. They devise the scheme of dressing the child in rags and dressing a distant cousin, a poor cousin, in rags, and sending the two of them off to a peasant village some miles from Hanover, in the hope that they'll be able to find lodging and succor. And if they have the plague, they'll die anyway. And if they don't have the plague, they can come back and pick them up on the way back from the fair. So with tears, but resolutely, they send this 5 or 6-year-old away with this elderly, orphaned woman who lived with them, to tell the people of the small town that during the fair, the Jewish homes in Hanover were overstuffed with visitors. There were no motels and no hotels, so you put up at homes. And the poor Jews didn't have a chance. They knocked on every door, could for a while, the townspeople take them in. The townspeople were generous enough to do so. And fortunately for Glückel, the little girl did not have the plague, and when her body became clean and clear again, she was brought back to the family. But again, that sense that that human life is relatively cheap, hard to hold on to, and you don't want to involve yourself too much in the lives of others, even those who are, in a sense, closest to you. The Jews lived on sufferance, by tolerance. When Glückel was 3, her family and all the families of Hamburg were suddenly evicted from the town by the town council, decided they didn't want Jews anymore. And they went a few miles away to a town called Altoona, which had already a sizable Jewish community for the day. And the men would walk from Altoona to Hamburg every day to work, and then would return to Altoona for the night. Now, what's a sizable Jewish community? Altoona had 45 Jewish families. Hamburg, which was a larger town, had 50. A family was a unit which was relatively small for those days. When we talk of an extended family, we think of a rather extended thing. But it had a husband and wife, the young children, some indentured servants, maybe a tutor, maybe a wet nurse, and this is a wealthy family, and an elderly parent or two who might be with them. And that tended to be it. There have been some studies of family density in Germany at this time. And most family units seem to have had around 20 if they were poor, and around 15 if they were wealthier. Jews lived together in what was called the Judengasse, the Jews' street. The Jews' street was usually right next to the moat of the old town, no longer used, but the moat was used as the garbage dump, and that's where the Jewish homes were placed. In most towns, though not in all, the Judengasse was locked in at night. There was a gate at both ends, and you couldn't leave it. Houses were 3 or 4 stories high. The eaves tended to touch each other across the street, because people were crammed into the space. They wanted to get as much space as they could. You had a sense of that there was a cover to the street. Sunlight rarely got down to the street level. Houses were made of wood. The great danger was fire. There more than one Judengasse was entirely burnt down overnight by incendiary, by an accident or by incendiaries from the outside. Every Jewish home had its shield. The wealthier homes had servants. Privacy was almost unknown. The bottom floor of most homes was used as a storehouse because the Jews were not allowed to have stores to display their wares. Storehouses and stables and living quarters, and there were sets of living quarters above. Usually the second floor had the dining area. Food was brought up to it. Food was fruit and fish and vegetables, not much meat. There seems to have been, during most times, sufficient food, but not always. Obviously, there was no refrigeration as such, a great deal of dried foods. A diet tended to be simple. Nuts and spices and fresh fruits were luxuries which were indulged in on the feast days and given as special advantages to pregnant women and the like. The Jewish life could be uprooted as her family's life had been overnight. Jews lived always on the narrow edge of disaster. There was no security. Every community had its own laws, and the great fairs usually were the places where the laws against the Jews were the harshest. In Leipzig, for instance, which was the greatest fair in all of Germany, if a Jew died while he was visiting the fair, he and all the goods he had with him and whatever he had with him were forfeit to the community. And one of the near relatives of Glückel dies at the Leipzig fair, and the family has almost to impoverish itself in order to bribe officials to release the body so that the body can get an appropriate Jewish burial. The appropriateness of burial was a thing of great importance to these people. And they spent thousands of thalers, thousands of dollars, in order to get this corpse and to give it some burial in the nearest town. In Jewish history, these centuries are really the nadir, the bottom, the most despairing of all times. She lived during the period of Shabtai Tzvi, of the great false messiah of Smyrna. And she describes how her father-in-law, who was by then an elderly man, is caught up in the contagion, the hope that the messiah has really come. And he sells his business, he sells whatever he possesses, and he goes to the nearest port, which is in northern Germany, and ready to jump on a ship for Palestine the minute the good news is verified that, in fact, the Messiah has come. And he sends to her in Hamburg, which is a river port, but a port nevertheless, three great caskets of dried food, the kinds of things you use on shipboard. So the food should be ready to be put on ship the minute, you know, he's ready to go, and she keeps these big caskets. Apparently they're a great bother to her for a number of years. Wow. First, the history, the sad history of Shabtai Tzvi unfolds. Towns were divided between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, between those who had come out of Spain or Portugal or came up from Turkey, and those who were German. The German community was now almost 800 years old. The Sephardic community was a somewhat wealthier community, an older community that had a little more shtat to it. There was no intermarriage between the Sephardic and the Ashkenazi communities. There was a great, you could marry anyone, but there were simply none. She had arranged some fine marriages for most of her children, but they were all with Ashkenazic Jews of some wealth in other towns. The families were patriarchal in structure. All authority, in the sense all property, was managed by and owned by the husband. Glückel, as many wives at the time, participated with him in business, gave him freely his advice, went out and did some business on the bourse. Her word was as good as his with other Jews, but she could not sign a single document and she could not act as a witness before the court. And so whenever she had to arrange something, she had to get her husband or her sons or some relative to sign the actual documents for her. Children had no rights. Children were totally dependent, and neither politically, legally, nor socially had they any rights to do anything on their own. They had no property or in their own name, and they received no property except by inheritance, which passed to them not at death, but when they became of age, which was 13, or by marriage. The greatest and most significant moment in a person's life was the moment in which they were engaged, when marriage was arranged for them, because this established their rank, their class, their citizenship, their future. Marriage arrangements were done with great care. The Shadchan was not the comic figure that we make him out to be on the Yiddish stage, but he was a very qualified assessor of family wealth. That was the most important consideration in these things. and he received a fixed percentage of the marriage dowry. One taler for every 200 talers in the marriage dowry up to a certain point, then a half a taler for every 100 talers beyond that point. He traveled far and wide. You made sure of all the arrangements before the engagement. Now, engagements and weddings were two different things. Nisuin and Kiddushin. The engagement usually took place 2 to 3 years before the wedding. The engagement did not require the presence of the bride, the future bride, and the future groom. What it required was the signing of official documents before witnesses by the families of the bride and of the groom. There was a betrothal contract, and a very, very heavy fine was imposed if anyone pulled back from that contract once it had been signed. And they went for every dollar that was involved in whatever the preliminary discussions may be. And there's one case in Glückel where she goes as far as Amsterdam, a terribly long distance in those days, to enter into a marriage contract for one of her sons. And after days of haggling over who had said what about what to whom, they can't get an agreement. And she goes all the way back home, even though there's really less than $100 involved in the disagreement. Your word had to be fixed, and what was looked for was first substance, because really all these children were guaranteed of was what was given in two parts. One part was called the nadan, the gift that was brought by the groom to the marriage, and one was the dowry, the dot, what was brought by the woman into the marriage. And this was what the young family would have to live on. Inheritance could never be depended upon, because you could be up today and down tomorrow, but what you got became yours. And usually a marriage contract was of this kind. So many $1,000 here, if they were fairly wealthy, so many $1,000 from here. And this was the basis of the marriage, an agreement usually by the father-in-law that the children could live for a year or two in the family home, presumably on the assumption that the son would study, but in reality it was to give him enough maturity to go out and earn his own living. And then you were thrown out of the nest, boys usually at 16 or 17, and told to make your own way. And it was a tough way to make. You lived by your wits, you lived by commerce, you lived by trade. You live by exchanging notes of negotiation of various kinds. You were not allowed to enter the crafts. Very few of the governing bodies in Germany allowed the Jew to own land, so you didn't make your living as a vintner or farming. A number of the women went into various kinds of needle trade. At one point, Glückel had a lace-making factory, a fine lace goods. And that was not at all unusual. Most of the men did not, however, make manufactured goods. They sold jewels. They would buy silver in one place and sell it to the silversmith's guild in another. Usually the poor people began as peddlers and hoped they would make enough to move up in the social scale from going from door to door. They would bring in merchandise from Italy, from Vienna, from Spain and Portugal in various ways and peddle it and sell it throughout Germany. You had children who did well at this, and a great deal of luck. At something he's not good at. Today we have all kinds of options, but in those days you didn't have this variety of options. And she has a son, Glückel, named Louis Leopold, who is a well-intentioned, good-looking fellow. He likes, he has a very fine marriage to one of the leading Jews of Berlin. And they rob him blind in the store. And it's not Gentiles who rob him blind, it's Jews who rob him blind, because everybody's living on this edge of terror. And he goes from one tragedy to another, and she bails him out once, and she bails him out twice, and she bails him out a third time, and finally, what do you do? Well, she tries to get him to come home, and at least it'll be cheaper if he lives under a roof and he can't get any more trouble. But he doesn't want to live at home. His wife has already thrown him out the door, but he really doesn't want to live at home, and it's a long sorrow. And finally, when he's 26, he has the good fortune to die. And she has a long rumination in here in which she says, really, he was a sweet boy and a nice boy, and it's better off this way. You know, there was really no hope for him. Now, the Jews of the lower class, the upper class, as I said, arranged very carefully their engagements and their marriages, and these were great moments in the community. The Jews of the lower classes, if they were upwardly mobile, tried to postpone marriage as long as they could to prove that they had wealth or to make their name as a great scholar. Then you could hope for a wife of a higher class with a larger dowry. Now, how is it that this small group of Jews, some of whom were able to make, for at least for periods of time, a rather decent living? Germany, at the beginning of the 17th century, went through a period which was known as the 30 Years' War. It began in 1618 and concluded with the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. The 30 Years' War is a religious war. It's a war between the South, which is Catholic, the South being supported by Spain, by Portugal, by Italy, and the North, which is Protestant, being supported by Holland, by the Danes, and by the Swedes. But everybody fights everybody else also in the process. It's a terribly brutal time. It's estimated that 1 in 2 in Germany died during the 30 Years' War. Devastated the country. After the war was over, rebuilding begins. And by this time, the philosophers, the economic philosophers of Europe, had devised a new system called mercantilism. A system which was particularly popular in northern Germany, because northern Germany, the Germany of Luther, the Protestant Germany, northern Germany had fought to not simply free itself from the authority of the church and from the abuses of church life that so disturbed Luther, the selling of indulgences, simony, things of this kind. The northern Germany had really fought as the North had in our own Civil War, to free itself of a feudal South, largely agrarian, which was still caught up in a set of values which had set little value on commerce, on industry, on the mercantile, on all those things which we take for granted as valuable in our modern social order. The church in southern Germany had looked down upon any dealing in money, any commerce. It was left to the worst classes of the society. The church forbade the taking of interest, which effectively prohibited those who accepted church authority from going into banking and doing the things which permit the growth of capital and the expansion of trade. But in the north, all kinds of people had developed this kind of mercantilist capital, which said the business of the state is to make money. The business of the state is to be strong enough to have a favorable balance of trade. And to do that, you must release the merchant from all the guild restraints and the feudal restraints. Let him pass with his goods as easily as you can through the inevitable tolls and the inevitable custom houses. Try to bring in raw materials and do something with them in your state and send them out and make a profit on it. Allow money to circulate freely and you'll be able to use it over and over and over again. And gradually you build in wealth into the social order. And the state which is wealthy is a state which will be powerful because the wealthy state is able to hire mercenaries who will go out and fight its battles for them. This is when Prussia begins to emerge, because mercantilism was the great theory of the Frederick I and the new Prussian state. And it's no matter of a chance that the mercenaries who fought in our own Revolutionary War were Prussian, Hessians. Because this is the beginning of the great mercenary armies of Europe. Now, as mercantilism developed, these German states of the north, the Protestant states, needed the support, because their populations are small, needed the support of the one group in their society which was A, literate, B, cosmopolitan, in the sense it had family contacts over a whole network of commercial centers, and C, familiar with the ways of trade, because rabbinic law at that point was far in advance of any law which existed in Europe in terms of creating the instruments of commerce and knowing how to deal with them. And the number of Jews in almost every community became indispensable in the 17th century to the development of commerce in Frankfurt and Hamburg and Hanover and Berlin and Vienna and in Strasbourg and also in Metz and all of these places. They became the factors to the prince. And though the prince had no use for Jews as Jews, and there was very little social mingling, the Jew became indispensable, at least for a short period of time, until he taught the non-Jew how to do the things he did so easily. And as the Jew became indispensable, a number of them rose to very high rank and great wealth. This is the great half century or century of what we call the Hofjuden, the Jew who becomes the controller general, if you will, of the treasury of a king, who provides the king's army with what it needs, who underwrites the king's debts, who sees to it that commerce develops in the state and so on. It was a very dangerous road. You went up very quickly and you could be destroyed very quickly. But the merchant Jew has a century or so in northern Germany in which he moves to the fore. There is some wealth. With wealth goes a number of amenities, though he still must live within the Judengasse for the most part, and he still must pay the Jew tax and all of that. And Vukel is part of that world, and she marries all her marriageable children into that world, and a number of them emerge as Hofjuden in their own right. Her great grandsons was Heinrich Heine. They're people who develop culture, and people of some of them of means, and some of them, of course, who lose the money along the way. Now, as these people develop a certain security in the sense of having a little bit of money, one thing becomes ever more important to them, and that is money. Everything is seen in terms of ready cash. Everything is seen in terms of your wealth. Every time she mentions a person, she mentions his worth. And which is to say that wealth was the sign of one's status in the social order. We talk of yuchus, of having important rabbis in the family and scholars. What was important was the dollars that you had. And the battles which develop in the community develop over money. And when she describes a family squabble, it's always over money. And these family squabbles can go on for 25 years and involve every court of the land. And they're always over money. From our point of view, it's rather vulgar. In their world, it was life and death that they were really talking about, and all their values were somehow tied into the money value. Now, she was a pious woman with it all. She was a well-read woman by the standards of her age, but she was avaricious and greedy. And the great pride that she took was always in how good a deal was, how much money was made from the deal. And when she talks of a son-in-law, she never talks of him as a bright boy or a good pianist or a fine painter or a scholar of worth. He brought into the marriage 100,000 thalers, or his father-in-law was the richest man in all of Bohemia. It's always in those terms. The home. Home is the center of life. It's all there is. You gave birth in the home. You were married outside the home. You died in the home. There were no public institutions as such except the synagogue. The synagogue was a place for worship. It had obviously a Weiberschule, a woman's synagogue, and a man. There was no division between the, there was no mingling between the two. There were women who were known as pious women, who spent their days in fasting and in prayer and in the synagogue. And they become something like holy women in this circle. She doesn't claim to be one. That's what her disclaimer at the beginning meant. But she was often in the synagogue. She certainly knew her prayers. The woman's shul must have been a fascinating place, because all the gossip of the community passed there. It was a place of... everybody looked everybody else up and down very carefully when they came in. And it was capable of hysteria. They were always very close to hysterics in this world. One of the interesting descriptions in here is when in her later life in Metz, she's in the one day she and her one of her daughters who's pregnant is at the Weiberschule. I think it was for Simple Star, but I'm not sure for what. And suddenly there's a, like tonight, there's a great sound on the roof. And everybody gets scared and the roof is falling in. And the Weiberschule comes sailing down en masse, you know, from there, and seven people get trampled to death in the process, and you can see the shrieking and the shouting. And the only woman who escaped unscathed from this whole thing was a deaf woman who didn't hear the roof and was so immersed in her prayers she never moved. She was fine. There are a number of scenes like this which suggest that this world was tense, anxious, tight, uptight, close to hysterics very often, and eager to make the most of the joys and the sorrows of life. There was great wailing at a funeral, and there was great joy at a wedding. And the joy at a wedding was not the happiness that you and I see at a wedding, but it was drunkenness. And it was abandon in that sense. They let themselves go. They needed that kind of release. And they needed that kind of release also at the funeral. They made the most of every occasion. If you read about a bris, for instance, to us, a traditional Jew, a bris is what? On the appropriate day, the young boy is brought in, and there is a moel, and there is a godfather, and the operation is performed, and there's a kiddush, and everybody is very happy, and we go home. In those days, a bris started 3 days before the eighth day. And there was a candle lighting ceremony in the house on three preceding days. 12 candles were lit. We haven't the faintest idea why. But 12 candles were lit each of 3 days. In some places, 4 candles were lit on each of the 3 days, adding up to the 12. The 12 was obviously important for some reason. It gave an occasion for all the women to come in and bring dainties and bring gossip and bring candy and have themselves a good time. On the Shabbos before the bris, the father was responsible for holding a meal that was required by custom for the entire community, for which you had to serve some schnapps, and you had to have a good bite, and you invited everybody in, and the community came in shifts, so that everybody came, and it was a great, great moment. And then for 3 days after the bris, there was another candle lighting ceremony. You know, and you went on with this thing. You never let any occasion pass without taking full advantage of it. Whether it was the wedding itself. The wedding itself, you'd think with an engagement thing 2 years before, the wedding would have a dinner the night before, perhaps, and the wedding the next day. Weddings went on for days. And there were for 5 days in front, there were all kinds of activities. So the bride would fast, and there'd be a great feast. The groom would fast, and there'd be a great feast, you know. The father-in-law would have to give a dinner. The mother-in-law would have to give a dinner. The other father-in-law would have to give a dinner. It went on and went on and went on. Very understandable. What else did they have? What else did they have? They had no TV, no radio. They had nothing really in their lives that was release. They had no mass sports. Not a single word is said in here about sports of any kind save one, the great Jewish vice of gambling. The medieval Jew was a gambler, a card player. He didn't have Las Vegas, but he played cards and played it often and played it for high stakes. And there are stories in here of men who lose their livelihoods at the card table. We know other stories, not in here, of rabbis who gambled away the congregation's treasury. One of the greatest rabbis in the Renaissance in Italy, Linda Mudna, is known to have done that. Now, again, it's a release. It's a catharsis. It's they're getting out from under the tensions, and they live with such tension that, in a sense, they've got to play in that way. There's a great deal of sermonizing by religious leaders against this kind of activity. But like most sermons, it went to naught. Life itself had, I suspect, few real joys, very little what we would call quiet, but a surprising amount of that you can see modern life developing. Glückel's father-in-law has had a good life. He wants to retire. He begins once a year to go to a spa in southern Germany to get the waters. You begin to hear of men who come together not only to do the study that's required of Torah, which is required of all men, but to discuss the politics of the day. Study is a fascinating thing. We think of Jewish life as pious, but we forget how important study was as a form of piety. The Musar literature, ethicalists, asked them to study every day, all their lives, the men. Many of them did. Chaim Chamelny, she says, studied at least 3-4 hours every day, whether it was at the fair or at home. He would get up early in the morning and read something. There would be, after shul in the morning, there'd be a little Mishnah class, and he'd study there. They studied both to learn, to internalize their tradition, because it was all the literature that they had. They did have books. We have inventories from certain communities. We know that homes had books. Poor homes had 50, 60 volumes of one kind or another. Printing was already in the second, third centuries. Rich homes had great libraries. They read. They read a variety of things. On the Shabbos, they would study with one of the learned men of the community. And this was a pastime as well as an edifying undertaking, as well as a kind of magical undertaking. And that's important. You studied for a variety of reasons which had nothing to do with learning. You studied to guarantee your soul a good deposit of mitzvot in heaven for when you got there, it would take care of you. You studied the way Jews in Eastern Europe used to recite the Kaddish. In many of the ethical wills from Germany, a man would say, I'm leaving money for 20 scholars to study for my soul for the next 12 months. And 20 poor Jews from Eastern Europe would spend next 12 months studying in order to hasten this man's soul into heaven. It was an assumption that you were doing good for the soul, you were speeding it there. Study was a form of, in other words, of magic, and seen as such, though not acknowledged as such. Life was surrounded with superstition, surrounded with magic, with amulets. Someday, if you go through the Temple Museum, we have a wide variety of the amulets these people wore. They put amulets on the woman who was about to give birth. They put amulets on the new baby. They put amulets on somebody who was sick. They wrote charms against diseases. It was their swine flu vaccine. And it was, I suspect, almost as effective. But there were all kinds of things that you did for superstitious and other reasons. Example, just one will do. Traditional Jews today have a pitcher of water on the stoop when you come back from a funeral and a towel there. Do you know how it began? Two ways, interesting, both of them German, although the superstition is older. When a person died, he died at home. So the first thing you had to do was to get the ghost out of the house. So the first thing that was done, you opened the window so the ghost would fly out and you quickly shut the window again. Then you had to keep the ghost out. So what you did, you poured water across the sill because ghosts couldn't cross water. That's an old acknowledged fact. Just take my word for it. And in Germany, there was a superstition that you never brought bad news. You never told somebody so-and-so is dead. Because there were all kinds of reasons for that, not to do that. So what you did in some of these towns was to hang a napkin or a towel outside the door as a sign that there was a dead person in the house. The water, the towel, and Jews as physicians who love hygiene, and all of a sudden we have the idea that we're going to wash our hands when we come back to the cemetery because the cemetery is a place of contagion. Now, the cemeteries were places of contagion, and it didn't hurt, but that's now how it began. And there were 1,000 of these superstitions, most of which we've fortunately forgotten. some of which, you know, still linger on in Jewish practice. Well, there you have the grandparents of your grandparents. They're nice. They were tough people. We'll just say nice. I don't know if they were. They were tough people. Hardy, hardened. Only the hardiest survived. It was not a world for the timid. There were very few romantics among them. The romantics didn't survive long. They had almost no childhood. They worked hard. They had a tremendous sense of suffering in this world as preparatory for the bliss which would be theirs in the world to come. They were not the most learned of all juries, but they certainly were literate. They produced a number of very important rabbis for their age. Emden, Ivershitz, Hurwitz, people of that kind. They went on to, some of them, to great wealth. The Rothschilds come out of this world. Many of them fell back into the mass. They developed a sense of difference from the Jews of Eastern Europe during these centuries. They were the first pre-modern Jews on the way into the West and to all that the West had to provide. And they were the hardy souls whose great-great-grandchildren probably were among those who founded this congregation. So, let me stop there, and you can ask whatever questions you can ask, and if I can answer them, I'll be happy to try. Yes? Let me do it, Oscar.
Go ahead. Right with me.
Yeah.
The book about a couple arranging marriages and doing the so-called arranged marriages. Yeah. Marriage. Yet, you say that the husband had to sign all the documents.
No, no. That often happened in Eastern Europe. It did not happen in Western Europe. The husbands worked very hard.